This episode is brought to you in part by The Table Podcast from the Hendricks Center at Dallas Theological Seminary. I'm Daryl Bach, one of the hosts, and I invite you to join us as we discuss issues of God and culture, which includes anything and everything. Listen on your podcast app or at dts.edu/thetable.
Today's episode of Quick to Listen is brought to you by Kinship United, a nonprofit organization rescuing orphans and widows around the world from trafficking, slavery, and death for the past 19 years. To learn more about how you can rescue an orphan or widow, visit kinshipunited.org today.
It is Wednesday, January 30th, and this is Quick to Listen, where we set aside hashtags and hot takes to discuss a major cultural event. On today's show, Bishop Ephraim Tendero joins us to talk about a church bombing in the Philippines. Thanks for joining us this week. I'm Morgan Lee, digital media producer here at Christianity Today, and I'm joined by my co-host and our editor-in-chief, Mark Galley.
Hey.
And I'm glad that Mark is back because Mark has been traveling a lot overseas too. Probably not as much as you travel, Bishop, but a decent amount.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's sort of good to be back because it's going to be, although I'm looking forward to tomorrow when it's going to be negative 22 to 25 with a wind chill factor of negative 50.
Yeah.
And I'm looking forward to it because, and our listeners might correct me on this, my memory is that in Jack London's Call of the Wild, there's a scene in which the main character spits when it's 50 below and the spit freezes before it hits the ground.
Tomorrow you'll have confirmation.
So tomorrow I will see if that really happens, and I'll report next week on Quick to Listen whether it really happened.
In case you need another reason to listen to the show.
Exactly.
Well, we perspire in our country.
Exactly. It's a little different. There.
Yes.
Yeah.
My daughter is actually visiting there right now with her adopted son, husband and daughter also.
I see.
To visit the orphanage from which they were adopted in Manila.
Okay. So. That's good.
All right. Do you want to tell us more about our guest today?
Yes. Mark? Bishop Tendero is head of the World Evangelical Alliance. He's been doing that since 2015. Before that, he was national director of the Philippine Council of Evangelical Churches since 1993 to 2015. The council, by the way, is the largest network of evangelical Christians in the Philippines, composed of some 30,000 evangelical churches, 69 denominations, 160 parachurch and mission organizations. He also serves as Associate General Secretary for Southeast Asia of the Asia Evangelical Alliance, and he's also my cohort in the Philippines. He's executive editor of Evangelicals Today, the longest-running Christian magazine in the Philippines. So given what Morgan's going to introduce the show, you'll see why Bishop Tendero is a perfect guest for us today.
We're glad that you're here.
Yes. Good. Thank you for giving me the opportunity. Though we are, half of the world apart, I'm here in Manila, and I'm thankful for the opportunity to interact with you.
When did your magazine start,
well,
Bishop Tendero?
Well, it started back when the Evangelical Council Churches was established. That was back in 1977. Yes. Mm-hmm. So it's a long time planning magazine. But we thank God for the opportunity of being able to present the evangelical perspectives as well as evangelical situation, how we look at situation in the Philippines.
Well, wonderful. All right. I'm sure some people would like some more information about what we mentioned at the beginning of the show, so I'm going to get into our discussion. ISIS has claimed responsibility for an attack that killed 20 churchgoers and soldiers at a Catholic church in the Philippines. Two bombs exploded at Our Lady of Mount Carmel in Jolo, where, according to our reporting, the first bomb blasted through rows of pews and the second bomb shot from the entrance to kill scrambling parishioners, as well as the guards positioned outside to protect the church week after week. The attack came several days after a key vote in the region's surrounding islands on a referendum that offered the area greater autonomy. While Muslims in Jolo largely opposed the referendum, which was part of an effort to end ongoing clashes between Philippine forces and separatists, it passed anyway. So over the years, the Philippines has been home to a number of Islamic terrorist groups, including one known as Abu Sayyaf. And Abu Sayyaf in particular has pledged allegiance to ISIS and has persecuted Christians for decades. It has conducted dozens of kidnappings, for example, including of Christian missionaries, And it also assassinated the Bishop of Jolo outside of Mount Carmel in 1997 and bombed the cathedral in 2001. This week on Quick to Listen, we'd like to discuss the relationship between Christians and Muslims in Asia's most Christian country. And we'd also like to get into the health of the Filipino church in the 21st century. So, Bishop, before we ask you some of the questions that we have about this particular situation, we offer a chance for Mark and I to react to this news. And so, Mark, I just wanted to hear your gut check and take on this latest incident of terrorism.
Yeah, it's interesting how some incidents of terrorism, you know, you get inured to them as a journalist. You hear about so many of them. And so you note it, and you're intellectually, in a sense, you're intellectually sad. But this one, I don't know, it touched me for some reason. So just that kind of ongoing deep sadness that there's this kind of violence in the world in general, and particularly against Christians.
My reaction to this was one of trying to just understand what's gone on. I kind of watched some of the headlines coming out of the Philippines last week with regards to this referendum that was going to be passed. And I was a little bit curious about how exactly this referendum came to be and what it was going to mean for the Christians that did live in some of these more predominantly Muslim regions. But given that the referendum passed, I was really surprised that this attack happened. And I was actually pretty confused by it, about given the fact that I kind of would have expected it more if the referendum had failed. But that may just what I probably think is happening there is I'm just not fully comprehending this particular situation. So I'm really glad that we can talk about it on the podcast today and provide some additional information for everyone who's listening to this. Bishop, I wanted to ask you some contextual questions about this before we talk about the bombing itself. The first thing I wanted to bring up is that for many people who think of the Philippines, they immediately think of Catholicism. But how long has this Muslim community existed and how long has it been around?
Well, first of all, before I answer that, I want to thank you for the interest and highlighting this news and being able to help people understand about what's happening and inviting me as a resource person in this discussion. And we thank you for that. In answer to your question,
welcome.
And in answer to your question, actually, Islam came to the islands in the Philippines earlier than Catholic Christianity. The Islamic traders come to the Philippines in 13th century, so they were there to do some trade in the Philippines as Arab traders. And Magellan actually accidentally landed in one of the islands in 1521 and brought Catholicism there. So, in a sense, Islam came in the 13th century, and Roman Catholicism brought by Magellan came in 1521.
Were many of the people who were encountering Catholicism through Magellan and through later explorers through Spain, were many of them previously Muslims?
Not really, because the concentration of Islamic, we would say, population was in the southern Philippines, and particularly the southwest Philippines. Then there were some spots or pockets in Manila. So when Magellan came to the Philippines, the most Filipinos there are, I would say, just practicing whatever native beliefs they would have, but not the predominantly Muslim population was in the southwestern Philippines.
From what I recall correctly about history, when the Muslim community and Magellan's forces interacted, there was actually conflict. And did Magellan die from that conflict?
Yes, Magellan, when he was trying to attack the one of the central islands in the Philippines, one of the local chiefs, Lapu-Lapu was the one who resisted, and Magellan was killed in that battle in Lapu-Lapu. But that is not, that is more the what we call the Lumad communities in the Philippines, not necessarily Islamic communities. Yeah.
So since that happened, when Magellan and his men arrived, what has the relationship been like between the area's Christians and Muslim communities?
The Muslims that are there in the south, have resisted both the Spanish and then later on this, the American colonization of their homeland, which is called Mindanao. And the conflict that we have in this land, in that land for the past two decades, was actually exacerbated by a number of social and historical, as well as social and historical factors. And one of them, a strong anti-Muslim bias by majority Christian population in the Philippines. So majority of those that are from the northern Philippines became, we would say, Roman Catholic Christians, as influenced by Magellan. And the those that are in the southern Philippines, called Mindanao, are the ones who remained as Islam.
Very interesting. And you were saying that in many ways, these Christians really just like didn't have a high regard for other Filipino Muslims.
So the Islamic community are in what is called now the, we actually have the region called the Autonomous Region of Muslim Mindanao. There are 13 provinces in that. But the rest of Mindanao and the Visayas and the northern Philippines have been largely converted to Roman Catholic Christianity.
Gotcha.
From 1521 to about 1898, we were under the colony of Spain. And then when our national hero, Jose Rizal, was executed by the Spaniards in 1896, that actually sparked that also sparked the revolution of the Filipinos against Spain. And then we were helped by the Americans who came in 1898 also, when Admiral George Dewey sank the Spanish Armada in Manila Bay in May 1 of 1898. And then after that, we had the declaration of our Philippine independence on June 12, 1898. Admiral George Dewey was even the guest of honor in that celebration of the Declaration of Independence. Then we had the short Filipino-American War that happened. And then after that, we were under the colony of America until about 1946.
And you had mentioned that the Muslim community had been able to keep its independence during that time.
Yeah, because the Spaniards wanted to colonize those Muslim community, but they were able to resist that. And then even during the time of the American occupation in the Philippines, they tried to subjugate that area, but they were not fully subjugated. In fact, the 45 caliber pistol was done in the Philippines, because during the time when the American soldiers were patrolling the area and the Islamic fighters will attack, they were just using this 38 caliber revolver, and even though they hit them, they can still attack the American soldiers. So they tried to have the higher power pistol, and that is the 45 caliber, so that as they hit the Islamic attackers around them, they cannot continue on and attack the American soldiers.
Oh, yeah.
Then later on, the American policy is to try to bring what we call the Tagalog or the Northerners and try to go to Mindanao, and they call it the Land of Promise. And it's a very fertile land. The good thing about the topography of that land is that it is not visited by typhoons. See, the Philippines being in the front line of the Pacific is visited by about 20 typhoons a year. About 5 of them will be destructive. And so it hits mainly the eastern border of the Philippines going northwards. But the southern, southwest Philippines was not affected by such typhoons. It's not in the typhoon belt, typhoon path. Therefore, it was a land of promise because it is a very fertile land and not visited by typhoons. Therefore, people are encouraged to go down south, the land of promise, and they can develop like homestead and occupy territories and develop that into rich agricultural lands.
And it sounds like, based what we know on what happened with the bombing, that there always has been a small Christian population that also lived in this area?
Yes. In fact, the population, the small Christian population that live in area live in harmonious relationship with the majority Muslim in those communities. But then later on, in the development, when the ones who were occupying the land, tills the land, more and more the Islamic communities are being pushed out further down south and southwest. And during that time, the Islamic people are trying to say we are being marginalized and we are being left out in the development in our land. You know, even as of 2005, in the Human Development Report, showed that the Muslim areas like Lanao del Sur, Maguindanao, Sulu, Tawi-Tawi, and Basilan, they continue to suffer the highest poverty incidence because they were not given the proper, we would say, development coming from the central government that comes from Manila.
So it sounds like you kind of think that some of the government policies have made this area a little bit more extremist.
Because they were being left out in the, as I've said, in the development. In the development is mainly from Manila and going up north and down central Visayas and Mindanao, northern Mindanao, but the southern Mindanao area are neglected in terms of development.
I want to talk about Abu Sayyaf. Mark, it sounded when we were talking yesterday that you had heard of them a little bit.
Yeah, because we did a story about one missionary couple that had been kidnapped by them, I don't know, 10 or 15 years ago.
Yeah, it was Martin and Graça Burnham, yeah, that was kidnapped
right.
by them. Mm-hmm.
So we're familiar with them at Christianity Today, at least
yes.
to some
mm-hmm.
degree. So how did they get, what is their relationship with ISIS right now then? Are they, there's two separate groups?
The ISIS, the Abu Sayyaf claims to be part of the ISIS now, and they have embraced ISIS ideology. But let me just start that the Abu Sayyaf started back when Russia invaded Afghanistan. When Russia invaded Afghanistan, the United States helped organize and train international Islamic fighters against the Soviets in Afghanistan in the 1980s. So after the Soviets left Afghanistan, then these Islamic freedom fighters that were trained in Afghanistan gave birth to various Islamist groups, and they came back to the Philippines. After that, one of their founder is Abdul Jarak Abu Bakar Janjalani. He came back to the Philippines in 1991 after serving in Afghanistan, and he became what is called the freedom fighter. Now, they were part of the Moro National Liberation Front then, but when the Moro National Liberation Front began talking with the government in terms of having a peace agreement, then the Abu Sayyaf group who came from fighting in Afghanistan said, well, their leaders gave up, they felt that their vision for independence was given up by their leaders because the Muslim wanted, they were actually secessionists. They want to separate and dismember that area from the Philippine government. So there was this Moro National Liberation Front that was there in the 1970s. Now, when these freedom fighters that came from, that were trained in Afghanistan to fight the Russians, after the Russians left already there, then they came back to the Philippines. They have arms. They have the training in terms of handling arms, but now they don't have their livelihood. They don't have salaries, and they have their own skills. Then they saw that their leaders are giving up the vision of their quest for independence when they started the peace talks with the Philippine government. And therefore, they started to behave like a gang of seasoned combatants. And they separated from main group of Liberation Front, they become combatants, and then they become like, we would say, bandits. They actually use their skills and training for livelihood. And what is that livelihood? Livelihood, it is the kidnap for ransom bandits that largely stays in Holo area.
So that's really interesting then that they've been around that long. And I guess when we were talking earlier about the missionaries, that would make sense why they were kidnapping people then, was for that ransom money. Mark had mentioned that this group had also pledged allegiance to ISIS. And was that something that was surprising at all? Or that just kind of like fits into what you were saying about them seeing themselves as kind of like this part of this global freedom fighters movement?
It was foreseen that they would, you know, when an extremist group will come out, then they will join the extremist group. And the main group of the Moro National Liberation Front, and then later on another group came out called the Moro Islamic Liberation Front. They were supported by the large, largely by the people in the community who are in the Islamic community. But this Abu Sayyaf group are disowned by the mainline Islamic community. And yeah, they became the bandits and used their skills and their training as renegade kidnap for ransom bandits.
So yeah, so they were rejected by the mainstream Muslim community.
Yes,
in the Philippines.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
This recent attack that just happened a couple days ago, ISIS has claimed responsibility for this. Why do you think they went after Christians in particular?
What they want to do is pit Muslims and Christians against each other, because they did not want that the majority Muslims would like to have that peace agreement to settle the century-old conflict between the majority Islamic community and the Philippine government. So as you have said, you know, the referendum for the peace agreement was just approved by the people, and that province, Holo, was one of those two provinces or two cities, two areas rather, that did not vote in favor of the plebiscite for the peace agreement. And therefore, it could be that because they don't want the peace agreement to really flourish, then they are trying to sow more terror. And you can see that in that church building, in that cathedral, many of those who died are also soldiers, because the soldiers are the ones who are particularly in the guarding that area. And people there are peaceful loving. I've been in that area. When I first went to that area, the person that greeted me is one of the sultans. In fact, when I first visited Holo, the sultan welcomed me from the airport, and he said, "Bishop, as long as you are here with me, no one will touch you." So you can see how the moderate Islamic community are peace-loving and would like to support peace. And they had that negotiated peaceful solution to the century-old conflict. And therefore, those that would be affected in terms of maybe they are using Abu Sayyaf to, and who are now claiming to be ISIS, to continue to sow that kind of hatred and not to have the peaceful agreement, because there are people who are earning their wealth and power interests by conflict. And therefore, they do not want the peace agreement to flourish. We have people who are involved in peace building in the land, in the area. They are peace building workers on the ground, and they have seen that it could be that the powerful parties may be behind the bombings, and particularly the one that has recently came out in the cathedral in Holo.
If I'm understanding you correctly, last week when they had this referendum, it sounded like in Holo, where this bombing took place, this was one of the few areas where the community did not vote in favor of the referendum. And so you think that they were singled out specifically because of that. Can you just give us a short summary of what this referendum was over, or what they were deciding?
Let me backtrack. the liberation front of the Islamic community started back in 75, during 1975. Then during the time of President Ramos in 1995, they were able to sign the peace agreement and started the autonomous region of Muslim Mindanao. However, there were some provisions in the peace agreement that were not fully fulfilled, and that actually gave rise to what is later on now called the Moro Islamic Liberation Front. And they continued on in the quest for independence. So first of all, Nur Misauri, the Moro National Liberation Front, was seeking for independence, a secessionist movement. But then in 1995, he entered into the peace agreement with the former President Ramos. And because of that, the other Islamic people said, why did you give up our quest for independence? And that actually gave rise to the Moro Islamic Liberation Front. And they continued on the quest for independence. However, later on, the leaders, and through the efforts of peace-building communities and other people who are trying to encourage what is what we call now the political settlement of the military conflict, because they said, you know, in war, nobody wins. Let's try to see what can be done. What is the win-win solution? And so they gave up also their quest for independence and began to have that negotiation to go back to the negotiating table. So that peace agreement between the main group, Moro Islamic Liberation Front, and former President Aquino was signed in 2014. And in that peace agreement, the Islamic community, majority Islamic community, would have the self-governing, we call that the autonomous region, that they will be self-governing. They will have that rights determination. It will be democratic form of government, but more or less like a federal state in the southern Philippines, but still under part of the national government. So that was the basic element of that peace agreement that was first signed in 2014. Then the Philippine government has to provide the implementing law in order to make that happen, that is within the Constitution of the Philippines. And finally, the Philippine Congress passed that law that was signed as a law in 2018. But in order to have it as effective law, it has to be ratified by the people who are in the area. And so that ratification was held just a few weeks ago, a few days ago. And there was a reaction in Sulu. Majority did not vote for ratification. Although from the reports that we have from the conduct of the elections is that in terms of the voting, there were many people who did not go out to vote because there was that threat that there will be some bombings and there will be dangerous situations. So many people stayed in the homes and did not go out to vote. So that's why the no vote won with a slim majority over the yes vote. But the analysis of the people would say if all the people went out to vote, then the yes vote would have won also in that area.
Wow, just the interesting twists and turns and ironies. You've mentioned many here.
But that land is a beautiful land. Philippines is known for one of the islands in the central Visayas called Boracay Island, which is a tourist spot known all over the world. But in southern Sulu and the different islands nearby, there are beaches there that are much better than the Boracay beaches. But it's hard to go there because there's still an ongoing conflict and there is that danger and there's terror coming from people who are using their wealth and power to earn their livelihood.
God is a genius storyteller, and the evidence of this is threaded throughout Scripture. In Christianity Today's new show, Holy Curiosity, with me, Kat Armstrong, we explore storied connections threaded throughout Scripture from the Old Testament to the New. Our first mini-series, Connecting Dinah and the Woman at the Well, welcomes experts like Drs. Tim Mackey and Diane Landberg to give us insight and context into the physical location and meaning of these two stories. These stories will spark holy curiosity in your own faith, because once you see these connections, you can't unsee them. God wastes no person, place, or thing. Listen and subscribe to Holy Curiosity with Kat Armstrong on your favorite podcast platform.
I want to zoom out a little bit. We've been talking, obviously, about the dynamics of this area on Christians, but I want to talk about Christianity more broadly in your country, and in particular, just the evangelical church. Is this a Christian community that you see as growing or shrinking right now?
The evangelical church is growing in the Philippines. Right now, our current statistics is that 80% of 110 million Filipinos are Roman Catholics. About 10% are Protestant and evangelicals. 5% would be Muslim, and the rest would be the other different religions in the Philippines. So the biggest group would be the Roman Catholics, 80%. The evangelicals and Protestant combined would be 10%. Muslim would be 5%. And the all other religions would be the remaining 5%.
And so what has been causing the evangelical church to grow?
The evangelical churches are growing, number one, because true to the name evangel, they are very evangelistic, focusing on the gospel proclamation, sharing the good news. They are very much involved in community involvement, as well as development, engaged in social, we would say, development of the people. So they are involved in what we call holistic gospel. It's not only the proclamation of the gospel, but the demonstration of the gospel. But there's also one significant development within the Catholic Church that happened, because if you know, in the 60s and then going on to the 70s, there was the Second Vatican Council. And the Second Vatican Council had two landmark decisions that was helpful in the people really embracing faith. And what is that? The Second Vatican Council changed the language and the order of the Mass. Before, the Mass is said in Latin and people are not able to understand what the priests are saying because it is in Latin. And then secondly, the Second Vatican Council opened the Bible to be read by common people or by everyone. And so this opening up of the Bible for everyone and then changing the language and order of the Mass, then it created that movement of people really studying the Bible. And then they can compare what is being said by the priest in their homilies, because they can now hear it in the vernacular, and then they compare it with the teachings of the Bible. And so those two factors created that kind of hunger and the openness and desire to know more about the biblical faith. And many of the people have embraced gospel truth and gospel Christianity.
What would you say are the church's, the evangelical church's biggest challenges right now?
Well, one of the biggest challenges among evangelicals would be still the lack of full unity among everyone, because the different expressions of our evangelical Christianity sometimes is a problem that we cannot work together. That's one challenge. Second would be the economic situation and condition in the Philippines, because largely, while like many other countries, the economic realities are the oligarchs or the people who have land and influence are the ones who control the wealth of the nation, and the large number of population are not having that enjoyment of the full wealth of the nation. The churches are trying to address that. So the Philippine Council of Evangelical Churches have been trying to promote that unity movement and relationship. And thus far, it has created in the kind of cooperation and growth. So we are having greater cooperation and unity now than in the past. And we thank God for what he is doing. That's why the churches are growing in the Philippines.
The last question that I just want to ask you is about the current president, Rodrigo Duterte.
Duterte, yes.
Obviously, you know, we who are in the West see a lot of headlines about how controversial he is, at least to our media, and some of the violence that seems to have been a part of his administration. And I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about how the evangelical community has reacted to him.
The Filipino Christians are divided when it comes to their response and reaction to our president. There are those who believe that he is God sent to save the Philippines from the hand of narco politicians and their cronies. And he is enjoying, up to now, more than 70% approval rating and of the entire population.
That's to the entire population or just among evangelicals?
No, that's the entire population. Now, in terms of the evangelical Christians, we cannot make, I think that a great majority are still the ones who are on the side of him, support him, particularly the coming from the Visayas and the Mindanao, because this is the first time we have the president who comes from Mindanao area. Of the 15 presidents we had, he is the first coming from Mindanao. So those that are coming from Mindanao and the Visayas are very supportive of him. Now, those that are in Manila, majority among evangelicals still support him because, again, of what he is doing in terms of his fight against drugs. The Philippine Council of Evangelical Churches, as early as 2 years ago, came out with a statement that we support the war on drugs, but we do not support the extrajudicial killing, and we appeal to the president that he tries to stop those extrajudicial killing and continue on the war on drugs. What's not reported in the international media is the other effect of what has happened because of the war on drugs. There are people by the millions who surrendered voluntarily because of this, and they said they want to stop taking on drugs and they need help. And the government tried to also reach out to the religious community to help in the recovery of this and rehabilitation of these drug users. And that gave an opportunity to many churches also to do Bible study and do spiritual ministry to these offenders so that they will not go back to that habit and to that problem. So there's that strong support. Now, there are also those who believe that the president, our president, is destroying the democratic institutions. And because of some of the expletives that he has and the strong man's position, then he could be eroding the moral fiber of the society. So those are the division that we see even among evangelical Christians. I would say that majority still support the president because of they believe, as I've said earlier, that he is God sent to save the Philippines from the narco politicians and their cronies. But there are also the other, not it's not half and half, but the greater majority are still supporting him. But the other are very much concerned that the democratic institutions and the moral fiber is slowly being eroded with the style of the leadership of our president.
Yeah, in some ways, it's not surprising. It is interesting that evangelical Christians in particular have, they do tend to like authoritarian leaders who get things done. I guess that would be the most neutral way of putting it, even if they sometimes push the envelope on legality. And you see that, you've seen that in Latin America, you've seen that in Europe. So it is an interesting phenomenon. And it's not surprising in that regard.
I was in Mindanao about 2 weeks ago. I heard one evangelical leader saying, well, the casualty in relation to the war against drugs is about 5,000, he said. But people do not know that there's at least 123,000 operations against drugs, the people using drugs and attacking those that are selling drugs. So it says 5,000 against 123,000. Maybe that's acceptable. But I said, brother, even one person who died, you know, is a problem. But we know it's not hard. It's hard to just do a one-to-one correspondence. But we say we are against drugs, but we do not want the summarily execution of the people.
So just for people who aren't following the situation, if I recall correctly from reading about it, what you have is law enforcement often going up to people that they suspect to be selling drugs or trafficking drugs and often shooting and killing them on the spot. Is that a correct understanding?
Well, actually, the instruction of the president is, you know, if the policemen, if you can see them, apprehend them. But if they fight, then don't get yourself killed. So you better be the one standing rather than the one being killed. So that was the instruction that was given by the president. And so to some people were saying that encourages the kind of situation where many people are executed. And the statement is, well, they fought. You know, they initiated the gunfight, and therefore the police authorities responded and retaliated. But the problem is, how do we know whether they really started when they are already dead? So that was some of the question that is being raised. So we are continuing to say, while we support his war against drugs, we are appealing that somehow a more creative way will be used on how to handle that issue. The drug problem is really an issue that has not been addressed by the past administrations in the country. And we are becoming a narco-politics country like other countries. And this current president is trying to address that. Now, one of the concerns that was expressed is that majority or the great majority of those who were killed on the issue about arrest on relation to drugs are the small, we call the small fry, but the big drug lords are not really apprehended. And that's what we are trying to ask and praying that somehow in this war against drugs, we deal also with a big, big fish and not just with a small fry.
What is the main drug that people are trafficking in? Is it heroin,
it's
cocaine?
It's called shabu or meta. The common name is shabu. It's the one of the cheapest that can be produced, and most of that is imported coming from other countries, and in particular, China would be one of the biggest supplier of that. And then they can actually put up manufacturing plants even in houses for that. So that's the most common drug that is being sold.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
I like to also say that this situation about war on drugs also gave us an opportunity for the churches in particular to work with the government in providing counseling and help to the surrenderees, so that the surrenderees are saying, we want to stop using this, we need some help, and they have some counseling. And so Bible studies are being done among those that have surrendered. And we have people who are saying that for those who have gone through Bible studies, those who have gone through counseling, they have very little incidence of relapse.
Oh, okay.
Going back to the use of drugs. As against those who do not go through counseling and Bible studies, then they have high incidence of relapse, even though they surrendered. And so in a sense, there is an opportunity to help them, to help in time of this need. And so we still continue to pray that as evangelicals and as a church, we will be able to continue to be the salt and light in the community and be able to provide, we will say, a long-term solution, so that we want to see the Philippines become a place where peace, justice, and righteousness reign, a Philippines where everyone has a decent standard of living, and a Philippines where Jesus Christ is recognized as Lord of all.
That's great. In fact, that gives me an idea for a story Christianity Today ought to do in the future. So that's very good.
All right. Well, thank you so much for giving us that really robust overview of some of the different challenges that the Philippines and the church community is facing right now there. That was a really informative discussion. Listeners who have feedback for this can offer it to us. We're on Twitter at CT Podcasts. You can also send us an email at podcast@christianitytoday.com. I just want to remind everyone who enjoys the show that you can continue to make it possible by becoming a subscriber to Christianity Today magazine. You can do that by continuing to support us by going to morect.com/podcasts. Obviously, we produce a magazine and we tell you about it pretty often, but we also sometimes talk about some of the other stuff that we do. And in particular, Mark recently was traveling overseas and got to give a speech in German, from what I understand.
No. Nine.
Wait, Mark, you went to Germany and you didn't speak in German?
No. It was amazing. I was at the University of Mainz in their American Studies department. And all the students in the American Studies department have to speak English. It's something called the Obama Institute.
Okay. Interesting.
So it was a conference on religious periodicals in the U.S. and in Europe. It was our host was Anya Maria Basimir, who's visited our Christianity Today a couple times, and then she invited me over to speak on how we go about determining content in Christianity Today. And it was just a wonderful opportunity to meet fellow Christian journalists, Mark Woods from Christian Today in England, and Felicia Ferraria, who is an incredible editor-in-chief, publisher, all-around, I'd say, publishing star in Sweden. Anyway, she was talking about her work and how she does her work and what she's doing, and both Mark and I, when we walked away, said she's very impressive, and we both said we'd love to work for her someday. So I met some very impressive people there. Got to talk about the nature of religious periodicals. It's just one of the things I do with Christianity Today, and it's really a privilege to be able to do that.
All right, so if you want to support more Globetrotting by Mark, you can do so by going to morect.com/podcasts. That's morect.com/podcasts. Now we have the moment you've been waiting for, where Mark can continue to talk about his trip via Precious Moments, which is when everyone gets to share something that has brought them joy in the past week. I know there's a bunch of cool things because Mark and I talked about his trip last week. So just pick one.
You can have it. Precious moment. How about a precious hour or two?
Okay,
With a slideshow.
Oh, go ahead.
No, probably the highlight of the trip was visiting friends in Bratislava, Slovakia. They are friends we've known for 30 years. He works for Habitat. He's been a vice president of Latin American operations. He's now vice president of European and African operations. They're one of those friends that we actually don't correspond that much by email or Facebook or telephone. We get to see them maybe once every 3 or 4 years because of our travels or their travels. Our families did a lot of stuff together 25, 30 years ago. All those kids are now grown up, married, having kids of their own. But it's an interesting friendship in that when we meet, it's like we just pick up where we left off. There's no awkwardness. There's no whatever. It's just that type of friendship where you just enter right back into the conversation like it was, we just saw each other last weekend. So it's such a delight always to be with them.
What did you do in Slovakia with them?
The most interesting thing was a tour of Bratislava led by a young man who was just thought Bratislava was the greatest thing ever, which is what you want in a tour guide. He was very... very interested in sharing the Soviet past, and I think one of the more interesting aspects of it, although generally Slovakians are very happy to be out from under the oppressive umbrella of the Soviet Union, he did say in Bratislava there are quite a few people, older people especially, who look fondly back on the days of communism because of the security it brought in terms of jobs especially. So I just thought that was an interesting thing to hear and realize, and then there was other complications about the history, but overall, very interesting tour, very interesting trip. Great time to be with our friends.
Awesome. So if people want to hear more from you, go to your newsletter, correct?
Correct. It's the Galley Report, G-A-L-L-I Report, which you can find at christianitytoday.com/Galley Report. And I comment on links, and many people seem to find it helpful. So I encourage you to subscribe.
Well, I want to thank Mark for this. From time to time, I also read the Galley Report. And You know, our magazine in the Philippines, Evangelicals Today, got its inspiration from Christianity Today. Because when Christianity Today started during the time of Carl Henry, it was there to be the magazine for the NAE, National Association of Evangelicals. And when I was leading, when we had the Philippine Council of Evangelical Churches, which is the Evangelical Alliance in the Philippines, we say, why don't we have also our evangelical magazine? And so we call it Evangelicals Today. So thank you for that inspiration. And we pray that we continue to tell that story of what God is doing and address issues and be able to bring biblical perspectives on the issues that we face in the world today.
Yep, exactly. Thank our purpose so as well. Mm-hmm.
Bishop Tendero, do you have something for us that's happened to you recently that brought you joy?
Well, one of that is that, while we have this controversy about our president, he actually declared the last Sunday of January to be the National Bible Day in the Philippines. Last Monday was the time when there was that celebration in the flag ceremony or in the radio stations. People paused to read the Bible, and that is called the National Bible Day. So it was declared as a special working holiday. It's still holiday, but it's a time for people to work, but a time also for people to take time to read the Bible. So we can say that this president wants to do something that would be significant under his watch in terms of what can be done to solve many issues, many problems in the Philippines. And we hope and we pray that God will continue to guide him and direct him. And ultimately, our hope is not on whoever is who sits on the seat of power in the Philippines, but ultimately our hope is on the Lord Jesus Christ, who said, he is before all things and in him all things hold together. And we pray that the sovereign guidance, direction of the Lord Jesus Christ will be upon our nation, so that we are not only called the Christian nation in name, but Christian nation in practice, as well as in conduct and all of beliefs.
Yeah, the one thing I never tire of saying is that the most political statement that Christians make every week is on Sunday morning when they declare that Jesus is Lord.
Yes, so. And that's our aspiration. As I said earlier, I want to see, and our vision is, the Philippines will become a nation where peace, justice, and righteousness reign, where everyone has a decent standard of living, and where Jesus Christ is recognized as Lord of all.
Is there a website that people can find out more about the work that you do, or someplace on social media where they can follow you?
It's called the PCEC. It's Philippine Council of Evangelical Churches, but the acronym is PCEC. So we have that website of PCEC. There's also a social media called the Philippine Council of Evangelical Churches.
All right. Thank you so much, Bishop Tendero. My precious moment, I thought of a lot of random different things, but one thing I did get to do this weekend that I had been wanting to do for a while is, there's this group that organizes some stuff at Northerly Ireland. Northerly Ireland is located near Soldier Field for anyone who watches football games or what have you. And it used to be an airport, and now they have just really like random stuff there. But once a month, they have winter events there. And so they have dog sledding that you can watch people do, which I had never seen dog sledding live before. And they also brought in different animals that some of these local groups had rescued. So I got to see like two different owls, including an owl that was probably like 6 or 7 inches tall. It was not very big, but it was very cute. They had free hot chocolate. You can sit in front of the fire, which was fantastic because the day itself was extremely cold, which I know Mark and I already discussed. But I really still like being outside as much as I can when it's chilly outside, and doing winter stuff is really fun.
Yeah, embrace the cold, baby.
Exactly. Better than being inside. I don't want to be inside very much. So anyway.
Is that why I could never find you in your office?
Yeah, exactly. Wandering around in the parking lot.
I know what it means to be cold. I did my Master of Divinity at Trinity Evangelical Divinity School, so I know what bitter cold could be.
You know. Yeah.
So I'm glad I'm here in Manila.
Exactly. Wish we were there.
I don't know. I think, honestly, I really like have been loving this winter because we've had so much snow. I don't necessarily like it when it's cold and there's no snow, but everything looks really cool right now. There's all these cool, like, ice formations. I was down by the lake on Saturday, as I was saying, and so you could just see the way that the ice has formed around these different plants or forms on some of, like, the railing of the actual, like, lakefront trail or just the ice floating in Lake Michigan as well. I don't know.
It's and some of the ice from the last some of the snow from the last few days has had that sparkly quality.
I know.
It's been amazing. Yeah.
I like when, you know, when there is several inches of snowfall and you can see, and just, you know, though you cannot see it with your bare eye, you can see the wonder of God's power. So, yeah, and those are some of the things that I enjoy.
Good. I'm glad we can all appreciate winter. It's a great season. All right. People can follow me on Twitter. I'm at MEPAYNL. That is it for us this week. Thank you, everyone, for listening to another episode of Quick to Listen. This podcast is produced by myself, Richard Clark, and Cray Allred. The music is done by Sweeps. Thank you to everyone who supports our show by going to morect.com/podcasts. We truly appreciate you. And if you want to do us another favor, you can rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts. You can also find the podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. We are super grateful for you. Have a good one. Bye.